This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Cobblestones Chronicles. And it's almost Christmas time, which is fantastic. It's going to be lovely to have a Christmas break. And I'm sure everyone at the radio station will continue to working, but I hope that they all have a really good break as well, and you too. This morning I've got another interview with Frank Fife, and the more these interviews have been played and I've been talking to people about them, people have been telling me stories about Frank Fife, never mind the stories that Frank Fife told, because seemingly he did things like he would rustle up controversy by writing letters to his newspaper complaining about something under a pseudonym, and then he'd answer them as the editor or as someone else even sometimes. So he sounds like he was a total character. And in fact, the interview that we're going to listen to this morning shortly is him talking about his life. And these interviews were done by a good friend of mine, Kevin Eichen. And Kevin Eichen, you might recognise his name and his voice, because for many years he was the Radio New Zealand reporter on rural affairs. And you would have heard him every lunchtime on the radio reporting on rural affairs. And this was something else that he did, because Kevin is also a very good folk singer and banjo player, of all things. He also plays mandolin and he sings. So that's how I know Kevin, through his interest in and his singing in folk music. So just before we play the interview with Frank Fife, I'd like to play you a song. And I thought this morning that I might play you a song called Eggs in Her Basket. Eggs in Her Basket is a song that is traditional. It was collected by Martin Carthy in the UK, who is a very well-known collector of folk songs and arrange, and he really was one of the people who led the folk revival in the 60s and the 70s in the UK, which of course was when I got interested in folk music, which is how come you get to listen to quite a lot of folk music on this program. So let's play Eggs in Her Basket by Martin Carthy.
It is off to sailor lands, both set out and walking, with their pockets a beam both lined with gold. As they went a walking and civil I talking, oh, some fair pretty damsel they do behold. Oh, one of those young men, should I chance for to carry your basket? Oh, there's eggs in the basket, oh, do take care. And if you should chance to outwalk me, at the halfway house you'll find me later there. These two younger men, oh, they start out for me, until they come to the halfway house, and it's landlord, a landlord, go start the kitchen. Oh, for you'll need your saucepan and skillet now, and it's landlord, a landlord, take back the blanket. Oh, for we'll give you bacon and eggs to fry. That lad, a lord, went up to the basket, a-thinking he'd got eggs to fry. say, younger man, ain't you mistaken? Oh, for in this basket we've got a child. Up steps this young Nancy, oh, dearest Nancy, that had taken to bed on last Whitsuntide. We got this young child's inside, claim your fancy. So now, gay fiddler, you've got to pay. That child's not ours, lovely Nancy. He's no bank of mine, nor no friends beside. Here is 50 golds I'll give anybody if she'll take care of this little child. Oh, I will take it, I'll kindly treat it, if you will say all my money's paid. Oh, that younger man went up to the basket. He's kicked it around and around the floor. Oh, since it is done, I will surely pay it. But damn me if I do eat eggs anymore.
Lovely. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And now I'm going to play you the interview with Frank Fife about his life, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Let's listen to it now.
How did you come to be in Greytown, researching the history of Wairarapa, finding amazing stories to tell, and writing books about these stories?
Well, it was at a suggestion of former Prime Minister Sir Walter Nash, actually, that I came to Greytown. He was a member of the English Folk Song and Dance Society, and we'd had a concert at the Wellington Concert Chamber, and he was present and came backstage to meet the cast afterwards, and congratulated us on some of the New Zealand material we'd done, and I said that I'd like to collect more of this sort of thing. It wasn't, you know, very well known. And he said, oh, the place to go is Greytown in the Wairarapa. There are families there that have been there since the town was founded in 1854, still on the land. They have a great connection with those sorts of things, and that's the place to go. And so 25 years ago this year, I came to the Wairarapa on a collecting trip, and have just recently published, 25 years later, a story that I collected on that trip. So, yeah.
So, when you came to Wairarapa, you were already collecting songs, I guess, as well as historical aspects. Tell us about that.
Well, I've been involved in collecting.
Actually, I'll put that again. So when you came to the Wairarapa 25 years ago, you were already collecting songs and things like that. How did you get into that side of things?
One of the things, no one else was. I guess that's the answer. If you asked people what New Zealand folk songs there were, what stories, what indigenous stories there were, people shrugged their shoulders and said, there aren't any. We're too young a country. And I was travelling in the deep south in 1960, or whatever, you know, way back anyway. And I stayed with some people and collected my first New Zealand folk song. And it turned out that it was an unknown version of probably the best known New Zealand song, and which to me said that if there are two versions, then obviously it had currency, that the song was sung. And here in the Wairarapa, it wasn't song so much as stories, and researching the background to those stories that have survived. They've been passed down by word of mouth from generation to generation. Researching the background, I never publish anything until I know what really happened.
Just getting back to those songs again, I'm trying to take in a sort of a chronological order now. What was that song that was the most well-known New Zealand folk song?
Well, yeah, there are two most well-known New Zealand folk songs. Shandy's By the Way and Bright Fine Gold. And in Bluff, I collected a version of Shandy's By the Way. And in Dunedin, I collected a version of Bright Fine Gold. One, the original skipping rhyme that came, the original of Bright Fine Gold, of course, it's an Australian gold miners song, a children's skipping rhyme from Ballarat, the time of the Eureka Stockade, and it crossed to New Zealand and took on a New Zealand flavour. And what I collected was the original children's skipping rhyme. With Shandy's, by the way, it was a totally different version, which led on to a study of that song and what currency it might have had.
So with that Tuapeka gold song, that's that Bright Fine Gold, Bright Fine Gold, Wanapeka, Tuapeka, Bright Fine Gold. That's the skipping rhyme you collected there, is it?
Yes, that's it. And it goes to a slightly different tune. It's a long rope skipping tune. This is going back. Said he, pausing while he works out the rhythm. Bright fine gold, bright fine gold, one pecker, two a pecker, bright fine gold, one piece for the master, for his hands to hold. One a pecker, two a pecker, bright fine gold.
Right, so how did this song collecting, collecting of New Zealand songs, fit in with the 60s folk revival, which I guess was going on at the same time?
Yes, well, I think we were grasping for a national identity, I suppose. It's all very well to sit there and sing about Sweet Betsy from Pike, but what about Sweet Betsy from Petone? You know, did we have those sorts of things? What did we do? What did the pioneer people do in New Zealand? And a lot of people uncovered a lot of songs. Here in Wairarapa, it was slightly different. I came armed with a wee tape recorder and I recorded over 90 songs here in Greytown. Most of them English folk songs that have been passed down. A couple of music hall songs, some patriotic stuff from the First World War, including one I'll never forget, Sergeant Daddy VC, which was sung by I recorded it just across the road from where we're talking now. In a baker's shop, the woman played the piano, and she had, at the age 5, she'd performed at the Wellington Opera House as a bond raising for the First World War. And this magnificent, tear-jerking song, Sergeant Daddy VC, amongst others. Associated with that were of course, all the stories. There were far more stories. And if you wanted to illustrate the sort of tradition, a heritage, an oral tradition, songs were not good here in Wairarapa, but the stories were. And in fact, some of the stories, you can see the oral tradition at work in changing facts and making distorting things to make them fit into popular conception.
Why do you think that there is such a rich tradition of stories to be had in Wairarapa, and specifically here in Greytown?
Partly because the it is a very conservative area. Partly because families have been here since whenever. They don't stray too far. There are families on the land that they settled in the 1850s. In fact, there's one family still on the land that they settled in 1844. The first sheep station in New Zealand was right next door. They would have been the first sheep station, but they, for economic reasons, they had to run cattle, so they became the first mixed farm. But they are still on the land from 1844. There are very few areas of New Zealand where you get that sort of continuity, and Wairarapa is particularly good in that respect.
So having come to Wairarapa at Sir Walter Nash's suggestion, I guess you stayed on, did you?
Yeah. Well, I love Greytown. Greytown, it was put here as a town, as a complete entity. It didn't grow by chance at a crossroads. It's laid out in the form of a church cross. Governor Grey wanted Canterbury to be here, but couldn't buy the land at the time, but had the town plan prepared, you know, nicely drafted and drawn up as they did in those days, these idealistic plans. And he gave it to the Small Farm Association and dusted it off and gave it to them and said, there you are, you've already got your town plan. And so Greytown is laid out in the form of a church cross facing north. So it came equipped with stores and... there were 100 shops, over 100, in the main street of Greytown. Today there's 24 or something like that. And it was surrounded by small farms, 40-acre farms, and they in turn were surrounded by 100-acre farms. So the whole thing was a planned thing. The result is that you've got a very special sort of feel about a town that has been here as a town since 1854, the first inland town in New Zealand.
So as well as collecting stories, you've been publishing them and getting into the history, and also, I think, working as a journalist.
Yes, that's right. I worked as a journalist on a couple of papers, both at the time of their centenary, actually. I was on the Times Age at the time of their centenary, and wrongly in 1878. They actually, I've just been researching the history of newspapers in Wairarapa, and I found out that they're actually four years older than they think they are. The first journalist in New Zealand, lived in this house. The first editor of the first newspaper came to Greytown and died in Greytown. I was on the Wairarapa News at the time of their centenary in 1982. I've worked as a daily hard news journalist and as a feature writer and as an agricultural reporter. I've also published, yes, and one of the difficulties about publishing, collecting stories is one thing. Returning them to the people is another. And what I wanted to do was to publish in a form that was readily obtainable by the local people, their stories after all. And so, of course, I had to be able to publish them cheaply. And the cost of publishing is very expensive. So I set about acquiring the wherewithal, the printing equipment. I now have 11 printing presses, and for the last 2 years I've been in business as a craft printer and publisher. And once again, it's a connection with newspapers. At the time, 10 years ago, the newspapers were going offset, and they were throwing out a lot of the old technology. So what was being sent to the dump in truckloads was a beautiful old type that had been cast in, you know, before the turn of the century.
So what you seem to have ended up with here is a veritable working print museum.
Indeed. I've got, the first book in New Zealand was published, was printed by William Colenso and translated by the Reverend William Williams. Reverend William Williams founded a dynasty of Williams in Hawke's Bay and Wairarapa. And they brought in a wee printing press before the turn of the century on which to print their own family history. I have that press, and I'm just about to print its history on itself. In fact, when I was setting up in business here a couple of years ago, I bought this house that was about to be demolished. I couldn't believe that New Zealand would demolish an historic building that you know was associated with New Zealand's first professional journalist.
Who was that, by the way?
Richard Wakeland, the father of journalism. He, quite a character. Endless stories could be told about Wakeland. He wanted to found a chain of newspapers long before anyone did this sort of thing. He actually printed a newspaper here, a Wellington newspaper here, and took it over in a horse and buggy to sell it in Wellington each week. An incredible man. Where did we get to? Never mind.
How much has there been a deliberate thing on your part to have this continuity, if you like, linking in the history of journalism with the history of print in the region, and there you have sitting side by side, if you like, or just in adjoining rooms, you've got a print museum and you've got computer screens as well.
Well, of course, you know, if the Victorians had had, if Gutenberg, the inventor of printing, had photolithography in mind, then he'd have used it in 1452. You've got to move with the times, which doesn't mean to say that you have to discard all of the best of what we had. And there is something about the old technology, which is I find, anyway, terribly appealing. It is a way of printing in which you've got the operator has tremendous control. Every copy printed by hand, you've got absolute control over the quality of each copy. It's very time consuming, but if you want to publish as a living in today's world, of course, you have to have the new technology. You can't write books and handset the type. Well, you can, but you would do one or two. I'm about to publish my 50th Wairarapa title. I couldn't do that without new technology.
And all of the books that you've published are on aspects of Wairarapa history or stories from this district?
Yes. I've published more than 50 titles, but 50 Wairarapa titles, that they are all to do with either oral stories, collected stories, or with the history of people like Richard Wakeland, New Zealand's first journalist, or Samuel Revins, the editor of the first newspaper in New Zealand. In researching Revins, I found the site of his house. I found the site of his gold mine, which was unproductive, by the way. I've located a block that was in his press the night the press burned, the paper burned down, and the press was lost forever. New Zealand's first newspaper press is buried in the Masterton Tip. While researching Revins, I uncovered some letters that are still held by the family that he'd written over many years from 1857 through to 1872, and I've published those. And they give an amazing insight into the world of that time. Here is an incisive mind and a good writer, a professional, writing about the events of the time. He writes about the scab and the downturn in wool prices, which we've just gone through again recently. He writes about the discovery of gold in the South Island, what it's going to do to the economy. He writes about what the American Civil War, the outcome of the American Civil War, is going to have on the economy, etc. Tremendous insight into formative New Zealand. I published the first biography on Richard Wakeling, a man totally neglected. Family members have come from Australia to, as a result of that publication, so that they can walk where he walked and sit where he sat and that sort of thing. I think it's terribly important. I've been very lucky to have had two such interesting characters, and I'm about to do the history of Masterton newspapers, which even the most eminent newspaper historian got wrong. I hope I get it right.
How far down the track do you reckon you've gone to mining the stories that are available in this part of the world?
I've scratched the surface. One man can only do so much. I have published 50 titles. I reckon that there are another 50 out there. I just won't have time in one lifetime to do the research necessary on them. So I'm doing what I can. There's enough. Every town in New Zealand could have someone like me beavering away and employ them quite productively.
Now, you're talking here about the history of the European pioneers, if you like. It goes back that far. What about further back? Have you been able to go further back into some of the stories of Māoridom, if you like?
Yes, but I've felt a little embarrassment about that. I really think that it's up to the local Māori community to research and publish their own history. I'd regard it as a terrible presumption to do that. It so happens that when I've come across something that I've regarded as quite important, I've done something about it. For example, I was very interested in the fact that in the North Island, the Wairarapa is the only district where blood wasn't spilt during the Maori Land Wars, and I wanted to know why. So I did do quite a lot of research in that area, and as a result uncovered and found the grave, actually neglected up in the hills outside of Masterton, of the rebel chief who, there but for the stroke of a pen, it would have been different. I found his grave. I've done a little bit of work in that area. There's a wonderful legend. It's probably my favourite, actually, which comes from the pre-European settlement days. It's one of the few love stories that has persisted in oral circulation for the past 160 at least years. And it's still told today as lovingly, I might add, and as probably as differently as when I originally collected my original version about 20 years ago. So I've done that sort of area. But apart from that, no.
Well, with all this delving into the past and researching the books and everything else, I gather you've taken it a step further now.
Yes, well, one of the things which I enjoy very much is conducting visitors to Greytown on historic walks. I walk people and tell stories while we walk and look at some of the old buildings. For example, Greytown is one of the very few, I imagine, towns in New Zealand where you can stand on the very spot where the first settlers camped the night, on their first night in the town. You can see the site of the well they dug to provide them with water. You can see buildings that were put up. The original settlers had to put up buildings to the value of £100 within 2 years or forfeit the land. You can see some of those original buildings. You can see in the main street of Greytown, it's probably the most complete Victorian wooden main street anywhere in New Zealand. The fact is that a lot of it has suffered during fires over the years, but even so, you can see everything from tiny workmen's cottages put up in the 1850s to rather grand homes built at the turn of the century. You can see commercial buildings. The oldest commercial building in the Wairarapa is in Greytown's Main Street, 1865. And it's still used as commercial premises. A lot of the buildings are still used for the purposes for which they were built, often 140 years ago. So to take visitors to the town, to these sites, the only haunted house in the Wairarapa, for example, and tell the stories associated with it, yeah, I enjoy that very much. In fact, I have people from all over the world who take advantage of that.
Lovely. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. The next one, I have got a couple of Frank's books that I'm actually going to read from in over the next couple of programs, because I thought you would enjoy them. There's one called Feisty Wee Cellini, which is a tale from Masterton of the 1870s, which of course wasn't long after Masterton had been set off. And the drawing I have of Feisty Wee Cellini, is she's wearing a kind of a Glengarry with a feather in it. So hopefully we'll listen to that shortly after Christmas. And then we've got Hallelujah, He Lives, a tale collector's tale from 1969. And it's an interesting tale because Frank says it happened. Although the more I hear about Frank, the more I realise that he was well known for embellishing his tales. Lovely. So, and now let's have another song. And I've got a CD from a New Zealand band called You, Me, Everybody. This one is called Pretty Blackbird, and it's actually written by a friend of mine, Kim Bonington, because it's a very pretty song and it's about a blackbird. And we see lots of them are in the garden at this time of the year, don't we? It's just lovely. So let's listen to Pretty Blackbird.
Sitting by the light of the moon. show me all you know. I can be there.
I hope you enjoyed that song. They are a delightful band. They are just excellent. I've known the Frangos Rhodes two boys, or young men now, who are in that band, since I met them when they were playing outside the ladies' showers at a folk festival in Auckland about 13 years ago. And they were then about 13, so of course they're now in their mid-20s and fully grown up, and laugh when I say I remember you when I see them. And they are fabulous musicians. Lawrence makes guitars. He makes, he's a luthier, and he makes beautifully sounding guitars. If you want to buy a handmade guitar, I totally recommend it. He's called Limelight Guitars. So, as it's that time of the year, and it's a time when we are shopping quite a lot, I know I've done I'm quite pleased with myself. I've done quite a lot of my shopping already. And we're actually having two Christmas dinners this year because I've got friends coming up for the weekend before Christmas. And then we're having Christmas Day and Boxing Day itself. And I suspect quite a lot of you will be doing that too. So you'll have a lot of bits of ham lying around. And I was, as usual, thinking, now I'm going to have lots of ham left over. So what will I do with it? You know, I have to think about it, apart from throwing it in the freezer to make soup with it and when it gets cold enough. But I picked up my trusty book about Inside Stories, A History of the New Zealand Housewife from 1890 to 1975 by Frances Walsh. And I dip into this every now and again because it just makes me laugh. And this morning, before Marina's here, recording this programme this morning, which is lovely. Thank you, Marina, for coming to my rescue. I was cleaning out my homestay, and it's only a one-bedroom cottage, but it's probably about the same size as original cottages would have been because it's 50 square metres. And, 50 square feet, I think. 50 square feet. Anyway, it's about the same size as the original cottages would have been. But it takes me less than an hour to clean it out because it's got wooden floors. And of course, I have my electric vacuum cleaner, which whizzes round. And I have my electric floor mop, which whizzes round. And I have a clever static duster, which I whiz round with. And it doesn't take me long at all. But I was thinking, oh my goodness, in the 1870s, it would have taken all blinking day to do this. And with a tribe of children charging in and out, it wouldn't have stayed clean very long. I mean, the only thing that happens in this household normally, until just before Christmas, when I will have a tribe of people, is that the dogs come in and they get shooed out. So I thought this, it's not always easy shopping, was very appropriate because it's not always easy shopping. And you think, and the days before supermarkets, what did we do? So in 1974, a Mrs. J.W. gave an account of her personal hurdle in a handwritten letter to Graffodes at Eve magazine. She said, "I am 19, have been married for 2 years, and we are both happy. We do, however, live quite a long way from the shops, and I have asked my husband if he would buy me a small car. He is generous and we could afford it. He agrees it is difficult for me to get out for shopping, visits, etc., but keeps putting off the issue. He feels I am rather careless and unconscious of things around me and that I am not yet ready to drive. Can you tell from my writing whether I have the requirements of a good driver?" Now, I do have a bit of a problem with this letter, because I think the fact that her husband is telling her that she's a bit unconscious of what is around her and maybe she's not ready to drive. But asking whether from her handwriting she has the requirements to be a good driver is just a little odd. However, Graffodes could read something from her writing and said, "It looks to me as though you would make a very good driver. You are not particularly accident prone. Your muscular coordination is good and you're an energetic, so you would not tire easily. A common cause of accidents is tire." Well, that's very true. Being tired is a very common cause of accidents because people lose concentration and nod off. But how you tell that from a letter being written, I don't know. Graffold goes on to say, "Your powers of observation are also very good, and there is a dash of caution and intuition in your nature which gives one the feeling of safety or danger in the situation. You are also mature for your age, but one of the best recommendations for you is that you are clearly a warm person and one inclined to give way in the situation." I think that's very interesting to get all that from somebody's handwriting in a letter. Although I did, yesterday I was writing down some instructions for one of my guests in the homestay, and he noted that the way I write is, he thinks it looks like I use a quill pen. And of course I have very cursive writing because I was brought up in Scotland, and we were writing was one of the most important lessons that we learned in Scotland, and we all had to have really good, clear handwriting. I also had a great aunt who was very keen on good, clear handwriting, and when I used to go and visit her, she used to make me practice my handwriting. I do have very good, clear handwriting because in Scotland, we were taught to write with a fountain pen. And those of my listeners who are a bit older will remember what a fountain pen is, but the younger ones might not. And you had to write clearly and slowly. And typing wasn't even in it. In fact, I didn't even learn to type. And it was on a typewriter until I was about 20. And I got off on a, I got sent off on a course to learn how to type, which has been useful, although we didn't know about computers coming in. But about 10 years later, computers started to be used, and it was very useful to know how to type, at least a bit. I've never been very good, but anyway. So, so to go back to "It's not always easy shopping," because I've got slightly distracted. Once transportation was sorted, there was a crucial matter of the vesture, and this one needed to be mindful of the destabilization effects of iconicism. R.E.E. of Wellington relayed her experience to readers of the New Zealand Woman's Weekly in 1975. "In town, for an afternoon shopping, I simply had to turn around for a second to look at the young woman wearing a white pinny, just like one those one sees in old school photographs taken from 60 odd years ago. Where did it come from? Why did she want to wear such a garment? Was she on her way to a dress rehearsal? Questions have been plaguing me ever since, until I feel I must have dreamt the whole thing. Very odd. However, in 1950, designer Digby Morton, famous in London, Paris and New York for his distinctly tailored clothes, acquainted readers of Femina with a more orthodox ensemble. For your best going-to-town clothes, I would suggest a suit, preferably in grey flannel, with as the smartest and most generally useful item. Choose a darker tone rather than the silver grey, which is inclined to go yellow quickly, and is very enlarging even to the slimmest of figures. I think that sounds very interesting. As Marina and I are sitting here at my dining table this morning, and I'm in a pair of leggings and a loose top, which is linen, and nice and light because it's quite warm, and Marina's in a shoestring strap dress. I think being in a grey flannel suit would probably have us melting. I hate to think what that... And anyway, he goes on to say the design should be fairly classical with perhaps interesting pocket detail, but the cut should be flattering. This means a defined waistline with easy fullness round the hips and bust. Remember, nothing draws attention to plumpness more than a tight, skinny fit. Well, I have to say that I'm very glad that I didn't have to be wearing a grey flannel suit to go shopping yesterday. I think I would have ended up in a puddle of meltingness by the end of it, because I was hauling quite a lot of shopping around. Well, that's almost time for the end, to come to the end of this little programme. I hope I've managed to give you a little sense of what it was like more than 70 years ago in the Wairarapa, and the kind of things that women wore and the things that they came up against. I'm going to go out by playing a song from a CD by Adam McGrath called Dear Companions. And Adam has been winning awards for this CD. And I thought that one called Trouble with the City, the song Trouble with the City, might be an appropriate one to play, because we're all going to be rushing around, and probably quite a few of us in the city over the next few days as we prepare for Christmas. I know last minute Christmas shopping is always the bugbear, and I know a few people who always leave their shopping till the last minute. Not me, I'm pretty organised. I need to do a little more, but there we go. So Trouble with the City is the CD I'm playing this from. I hope you enjoy this song.
The trouble with this city is the fact that you were in it. Trouble with this city is I'm in it too. Well, the trouble with this city, can I make it separate? Can I make it separate? Separate from you. Well, it's just me that came here, but now I gotta go. just 3 hours in a plane ride till I can get back home. Trouble with this city, all the people to and fro. The trouble with this city is no one seems alone. Well, the trouble with this city, and amongst all the noise and hum, can never find a word us both from harm. Well, it's true it's me that came here, but now I've gotta go. Just 2 hours in a plane ride till I can get back home. Trouble with this city is the fact that you are in it. Trouble with this city is I'm in it too. Well, the trouble with this city, especially now you have another, is I still got you. You both have each other. Well, it's true it's me that came here, but now I gotta go. Just 1 hour and a plane ride till I can get back home.
Well, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you have a lovely festive season with family and friends, or if you're on your own, that you manage to get somewhere where you can join in the festivities, and that you have a relaxing time. Remember to relax. Thank you for listening. And as always, if you have any questions or ideas for me, get in touch with me through Cobblestones Facebook page or phone Cobblestones and leave a message for me to come and talk to you. Thank you for listening. Bye.